The committee will please come to order. Our next presentation is by Trent Wright from the Idaho Automobile Dealers Association. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for the invitation. Well, for starters, the Idaho Auto Dealers Association has been trying to bring its presence up to par here at the State House the last couple of years, and certainly appreciates our invitation to be at the committee. This is our first time presenting, so bear with us as we kind of get through this presentation a little bit. For starters, just in case any of you don't know, the one handout I did give out is what the Idaho Auto Dealers, the franchise car dealers in Idaho, mean to the state. And it's quite a bit of information that a lot of people are set off with. You know, for starters, the average sales per dealership are $26.2 million. Total sales of all new vehicle dealerships in Idaho is $3.2 billion, which roughly equates to 18.3% of the state's total retail sales economy. And I think that we figured out last night that sales tax dollar for retail sales was anywhere from $1.18 billion to $1.26 billion, depending on whether you include December or not. And the estimated number of franchised dealers in Idaho is 123. We do have some of the more what we would consider high-paying jobs, of the average being $42,000 to $43,000. And the average number of employees per dealership is 47. In the state, people have asked us how our employment is going. We were cruising up upwards of 5,800 employees for all of our dealerships combined, but probably in the last quarter to quarter and a half, we've experienced anywhere from a 3 to an 8% layoff of employees in our dealerships, and of the remaining employees, a third of them have all agreed to take about a 10% salary cut or commission cuts in their pay structure. So it's a little hard to predict how the numbers will be this time next year based on those declines, but those are some of the employment and salary numbers that we're looking for our industry in Idaho. I've got a few facts and figures that go along with the national auto sales, and we'll get right back into Idaho. Weak December sales cap off a grim 2008. Automakers and dealers greeted the new year with relief as 2008 drew near. Unfortunately, though, before we could complete 2008, we saw the worst month yet since 1992. Overall, adjusted for business days, we were down, the nation, that is, was down 35.5% from December 2007. Despite the rise in average incentives when you buy a vehicle of $2,900. This was the fourth straight month in which sales tumbled more than 25% in the nation. With the change in the fuel economy that we've seen in recent months, international makes gained a market share of the majority. With more than half of the international makes are assembled in North America, and the percent was up to 50.7% of all retail vehicles that were purchased in the last quarter nationally. Year-to-date, international nameplates held a 52.4% of the market, which is just up from the titling that I mentioned a second ago. Of all the international makes, no surprise, Toyota held the largest share of percentage with a 16.7% market share. One bright spot for American manufacturers is that American-made top-selling vehicles still held steady in the top 10 mark. In December, U.S. manufactured vehicles held 5 of the top 10 slots of the best-selling cars, and only twice in 2008 did international makes top that list. In May and June, when the fuel costs were spiraling upwards and consumers began their transition to smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Trucks versus cars, this hits Idaho a little bit more close. Over the past 12 months, international makes beat the Detroit 3 when it came to car sales, but domestic manufacturers hold the lead when it comes to light truck sales, selling 111,000 more than internationals in December alone. During the past year, international manufacturers became known for their smaller, fuel-efficient vehicles, while their domestic counterparts remain the leaders in trucks. In Idaho, we're roughly 70% light trucks, SUVs, and vans, and 30% small subcompact cars. The final outlook for the national picture is the national sales forecast. At the beginning of 2008, we were projecting anywhere from 15 to 16 million vehicles nationwide, with analysts from J.D. Power lowering their expectations in July to around 14.2. And as we finished up 2008, nationally, we were at 13.2 million vehicles. Now back to Idaho, a much more relevant picture. And this slide here, real quick, just shows, once again, a little bit of a transition of the market share from the heavy vehicles to the subcompact cars on a national level, and the different market shares that they took, most notably because of the changes in fuel costs. The current confluence in events is without historical precedence, which complicates the task of forecasting Idaho new vehicle sales in 2009. However, with a heightened level of uncertainty, there are several primary indicators that will direct the course of the market, and these are up in front of you here. Of these four factors, excessive household debt will likely exert the most downward pressure. However, I would like to point out number two there, pent-up demand. When new vehicle market conditions deteriorated significantly over the past 2 years, people have really started to hold on to their cars. Postponed new vehicle purchases are starting to reach that significant level and should provide a level of support to the market in late 2009. Some of the Idaho market highlights, maybe we'll just call this Idaho market, outlook wrap-up for 2008. As we finished calculating the year-end numbers, we're still not quite there yet, but we're expected to predict a decline of 25.4% in 2008 during the fourth quarter, and a 22.4% drop for the entire year in Idaho. 2009 forecast, the Idaho new retail light vehicle market is expected to decline 10.3% from 2008 to 2009. The third consecutive annual decline. I know that that's not a very promising number. However, if you're looking at a 22.4% drop in 2008 and we're only experiencing a 10.3% drop in 2009, that is a significant positive attribute, and our dealers are very happy to look forward to that 10% versus what we faced in 2008. I think that when we're looking at the numbers, we reached what we consider the bottom. And even though we are experiencing some more declines next year, it is an onward-looking and looking-up procedure from this point forward. County markets, of the 10 largest county makes in the state, the smallest decline in new vehicle registrations was Bonneville County with 15.5%. The Idaho market likely to improve. The total titles or total new vehicle sales in the state of Idaho for 2008 was 35,789. The number on the slide there is just under by about 500 after we calculated December into that. Recent events have provided a clear picture of the underpinnings of the economic growth during the past few years. And for the most part, as you know, it's not a pretty picture. As a result, our long-term view of the Idaho market has been changed somewhat. So as I mentioned, in 2007, we sold roughly 42,500 units in 2007. So 2008, where did we wind up? Like I mentioned, 35.5 or 25.4% decline. What we're projecting for 2009, 2010, 2011, once again, isn't promising, doesn't put us back where we were in the past, but like I said, we've reached that heavy drop. We're still expecting a drop, but 10.3%, 31,500 for 2009, and then a 4.8% increase to 33,000, and then in 2011, we're right back where we're at 2008 with an 8.3% increase at 35,750. What's the best case and worst case scenarios for the Idaho market. The best case scenario, heroic efforts by the governmental agencies to resuscitate the financial system work quickly and effectively, and the housing market starts to recover. As a result, conditions start improving by mid-2009, credit markets start functioning again, resulting in a rebounding economy and rising employment, and allowing consumers to simultaneously reduce debt and jumpstart spending. Under this scenario, new vehicle sales increased slightly from 2008 to 2009 and head sharply higher into 2010 and 2011. The worst case scenario for Idaho is that despite substantial efforts to unclog the system, credit markets remain liquid as financial institutions continue to be bogged down by ailing balance sheets and a boatload of near worthless financial assets. Banks remain hesitant to write new loans, limiting any recovery in housing and leading hesitant households to keep purse strings closed. As unemployment rises under this scenario, new vehicle sales would head sharply lower next year, with a slow recovery taking hold in 2010 at the earliest. Real quick, this slide that you've got right up here shows the market share for vehicles 2 to 4 year old moving higher. Similar to what Mr. Benson said from ITD a moment ago, people are holding onto their vehicles longer, and the individuals who are choosing to come in and buy new vehicles are skipping the actual new vehicle and looking to maybe a 2 to 4 year vehicle, mostly because of the reduced cost that is attributed to that. We're seeing a significant growth in those vehicles. Not so much the older used vehicles, but the newer ones. I would like to mention that our fixed income operations, our machine shops, our mechanic shops, and our lube oil bays at our dealerships are experiencing some fairly good growth, but it's pretty difficult for us to track those numbers at this point. The last couple of slides I'll show you here, and then I'll get to questions. These are just county slides. As you can see, these are the state's 10 largest county makes moving lower. The ones in the yellow are pending, are the counties that stand out in their particular category. New vehicle sales, percent change, unit change, and light truck market share percentage changes. And then the last slide here is once again the 10 largest counties markets moving lower as we're talking about domestic brands and top-selling brands in year-to-date 2008 through October. The Idaho Auto Dealers and our members are experiencing something that they're not used to experiencing unless some of the old-timers have been in for quite a while. But even those guys have said they've never experienced what we're in right now. We have only lost one franchise dealer in the state of Idaho, the Bill Buckner operation in Emmett. I think that says a lot about the state of Idaho and our conservative nature of our members. Utah, Montana, and Idaho are the three states that are really bucking the trend in the West. If you look to Washington, Oregon, California, and Nevada, they are losing dealers in by the dozens every month at this point because of their saturation of markets. And because of other economic forces that are just driving them out of business left and right. I'd be happy to answer any questions about car sales in the state of Idaho that you might have at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Committee questions. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, quick question on the handout. The total sales figure, $3.2 billion, is that net of trade-ins?
Mr. Wright.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen, yes, sir, that is.
Further questions, committee? Senator Giddey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wright, I'd like to thank you for your very forthright projections for 08, 09, and 10. That hasn't been necessarily what we've been receiving.
Hear, hear. Community, any further inquiries? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. I look forward to it next year.
Community, next on our docket is a presentation from Pam Eaton representing the Idaho Retailers Association. Pam, welcome to the committee. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Pam Eaton, President and CEO of the Idaho Retailers Association and the Idaho Lodging and Restaurant Association. Between these three industries, the retail, restaurants, and hotels, the association represents all types and sizes all across Idaho, which is one-third of the non-agriculture workforce in Idaho. We bring in about 42% of the general budget through our sales tax and product tax. And if you add in the other taxes that retailers, restaurants, and hotels pay through corporate income tax and the taxes their employees pay, it's estimated that these industries represent up to 60% of the general fund. So they're pretty important industries to Idaho. We'll start off real quick. We always get the question about the Christmas season. Everyone's always curious, so I'll give you a quick rundown of the Christmas season. It fared better here in Idaho than everyone thought. That doesn't mean it was good. It just means it wasn't as much of a loss as all the retailers geared up for and expected. You probably witnessed retailers brought in less inventory because they were expecting the worst. You probably saw a lot of empty shelves because they didn't bring in as much inventory and people were shopping. The losses weren't as bad in Idaho as they were at the national level. And there were retailers across Idaho that actually reported an increase in sales this Christmas. Not a large increase, but there were some increases in sales across Idaho. The high gas prices early on kept shoppers more local. So people weren't driving to Salt Lake City, and that might have contributed to the downturn a little in Boise because not as many people traveled to Boise to shop. And then we had the snow, which kept people at home too. So a lot of our smaller markets across Idaho fared okay this Christmas season. Retailers did have to use constant advertising, enticements, sales to get people in. But they always had people in their stores. The traffic was up. People might not have been spending as much, but they were spending. Like I said, our retailers were pleasantly surprised. Now, did they still have a decrease? Yes, but it wasn't double-digit decreases. It was minor decreases. So that's a quick explanation of the Christmas season. Tax numbers aren't in yet, but I look forward to see what the sales tax numbers are for December, because I don't think this, or we're hoping they're not going to be as bad as everyone thinks, because we were hearing through the media, doom and gloom in retail, it's awful, worst case since the 90s, and I don't think it was as bad in Idaho from what we're seeing from all of our members. So I'm hoping not that the tax returns will be super strong, but that they won't be totally down, like I think everyone's bracing for. And a couple other things about maybe what's being bought out there. There is a reduction in high-end items being purchased, but people were spending money at Christmas. TVs and other things were being bought as gifts. It was some of the middle-priced items that weren't being bought. People either went less expensive or they splurged on the big ticket prices. The other thing is teenagers. All stores catering to teenagers have seen an increase this year and are projecting increases this following year and the following year after that. Teenagers tend to have money and they spend money. So I don't know why, but that's the phenomenon that we're seeing. We're also seeing, as some of you are snickering, we're seeing a trend right now where men are still spending. They're still buying what they want to buy. We're not seeing a decrease in any of those items either right now. We might not be seeing an increase, but there's not a decrease. Where we're seeing decreases is what women typically buy. It's the women who are trying to save money for the family. So your lotions and potions, your fashion accessories, your hair and nail things, a lot of the things that women consider splurges are hurting right now, and those types of stores are seeing deep decreases and are planning on continuing seeing decreases at least until consumer confidence comes back. As far as closings and openings this last year, I think you'll be surprised. Everybody remembers when there's a closing because it's sad or, oh no, this store is closing or this restaurant is closing. But we've had a lot of the openings that you just might not notice, or at least not notice for a while. It's hard to track actual retail because you don't have to have a retail license. We can track restaurants a little bit better through if they serve any alcohol or beer and wine. But so we have to just work with our members, we work with the chambers, and we work with the economic development localities to find out how many openings and closings there are. And we discovered that all across Idaho, the openings in 2008 actually outpaced the closings. Not by much, just by a tad, but they did. Idaho Falls, Nampa, and Pocatello fared the best in 2008, and Pocatello is experiencing some expansions on manufacturing plants and at a hospital, which we expect will bring more retail and restaurants to that area shortly, and so that's good news. Rexburg and Twin Falls seem to be holding steady, and it was actually only Coeur d'Alene and Eagle that seemed to have a few more closings than openings this last year. We are seeing some of our bigger chains that were planning on opening stores in 2009, 2010 are still going forward in Idaho on opening. So we will see, I'm not going to name names because some of it's proprietary and not set in stone yet, but we will see some large warehouse stores opening, some large discount stores opening, some of the combo food and other item stores opening across Idaho, and quite a few. There's still lots of pharmacies opening across Idaho. None of them have slashed their plans. Now, they might be slashing their plans for farther out, 2011 and 2012, and putting things on hold, but right now, openings in 09 and 10 are still on. Now for some projections, some more projections on actual sales. I'm going to give you worst case scenario from what my guys are looking at, which I think is actually better than the national level, which is good for Idaho. Oh, and one more thing that I did want to mention. When we see some of our major stores close, like I know some of the presentations yesterday were bringing up Mervyn's and Linens and things, and there's not going to be as many of those closing in the future as maybe was alluded to, although we will see some more of those. But the good news in Idaho is because we have such a small population and we have very few actual large retail centers, that when one of those stores do close, it really only is about five to seven stores across Idaho that are closing. So we're not losing like when they close in Washington State or some of our neighboring states, where 30 to 40 to 50 stores are closing and all those people are out of jobs. So granted, they have more population, but that's a little good news for Idaho. When things are happening on the national level, it doesn't impact us as much. We have more independent retailers, restaurants, and hotels in Idaho. So back to the projection for sales. We are projecting an 8 to 10% decrease in sales over the next 18 months. And again, I think that's worst case scenario. That's what the retailers are preparing for. They're hoping to be surprised like they were this Christmas season. They're hoping that consumer confidence starts increasing now that the whole election is over and we're going to get started. The new Congress and the new president is going to start. We're hoping that by about May or June, everyone will have a better idea on what's going to happen and consumer confidence will come back a little bit stronger, particularly here in Idaho. What we're seeing is people still have the money here. They still have the cash here. The debt isn't as high in Idaho as it is in other states. People just don't want to spend it, so we just have to entice them to spend it. And again, that is all on consumer confidence, and so we're hoping that will even out. But like I said, they're preparing for an 8 to 10% decrease in the next 18 months. on the flip side, when I said people have the cash, they're projecting a 2% increase in real disposable personal income. People are paying with cash now. They're not paying with credit as much as they are. They're not coming into stores and getting additional lines of credit like they used to. People are afraid of getting in debt and getting in too far now. I think a lot of people are finally starting to wake up and realize that they should only be spending what they have. So we're actually going to see an increase in cash being spent in Idaho. Another thing is we still do have many retail stores and restaurants and some hotels planning to open. So when my retailers are telling me, my retailers and restaurants are telling me we're preparing for an 8 to 10% decrease, they're talking about their store. But when we look at the entire economy and all of the stores and all the new stores that are coming in, we're hoping that for the economy in Idaho, that might only result in a 6 to 8% decrease or 5 to 6 to 7% decrease because the money's being spread out more because we are seeing more retail come in and we're hoping that the current retailers and restaurants that are out there will hold on and that we will see some growth versus decline in actual stores and restaurants and hotels. I think with that, I will stand for questions.
Thank you very much for that presentation, Pam. Committee questions. Senator LaFaber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Pam, have you been tracking with the openings and closings how the mix in Idaho is changing, if it is changing, between national retailers and locally owned stores and in the size of the stores?
Mrs. Eden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, it's been interesting because we have been gained some more national, as many national chains that have closed this year, we've gained just as many. But they might be in different areas. Some of the smaller towns, they might have had 6 independent smaller retail stores closed, but they had 3 big national chains open this year. So, but I don't necessarily want to say that the national chains are taking over because if you look at all of the openings, the majority were independent or small. They weren't the national guys. But the national guys that do come in, they actually help independent stores. Because when they come in, retail actually grows around. If a big store comes in, you'll see a lot of little stores open around them. In addition, if the big guys don't have it, the little guys usually will provide a little bit better customer service, or the little guys can always find a niche. So big guys coming in doesn't drive out the small guys.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible you could bring us some numbers?
Mr. Chairman, for exactly what's opening or?
For the mix and kind of the net numbers or something.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can try, but what's hard is most cities and the state doesn't require a business license. Most cities don't require a business license. So it's tough to pull up actual numbers of here is every retailer in that state. I mean, we do some research and purchase some research that will show it, but it's almost by the time we get it, because as you know, retail and restaurants are very volatile. So it's almost by the time that we get it and we're looking at it, I can go through it and go, well, no, that person's closed, that person's closed, and I know that this and this and this have opened. So it's very difficult to get exact numbers, but I can put together approximations for you on what I have for this presentation.
Quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Just a favor.
Typically, it's just a snapshot. It's just helpful, even a year-to-year or something.
Mr. Chairman, I will give that a shot.
Thank you. Thank you. Further questions, committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation, Pam. Thank you for being here. Committee, next on our agenda is a presentation from Mr. Jack Myers of Blue Cross Idaho. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Chairman Barrett. My comments before you this morning are really from the perspective of Blue Cross of Idaho. We have about 37% share of the commercial insurance, health insurance market in the state, along with Regions Blue Shield. They have another 20% market share. So together we're about 57% or so. And the other carriers are mostly out of state, a couple of other small insurance plans within the state. But many of my comments here are from our perspective, and then some of the data is inferred from our market share proportion. We have about 383,000 medical insured members and another 160,000 dental insured members who are not also insured with our medical plan. Okay, just to look at the overall state of the medical insurance sector, obviously the economy and the financial markets declines are having an impact on us, but I believe that the impact is not as great in some of the other industries that you've heard presentations from. Financial stability will continue to remain strong. We in the health insurance market really want to pay attention to what are our capital reserves and are they adequate to meet the increasing risk of ever-increasing medical insurance costs. And both of the Blues plans have very strong capital positions, and so they will remain strong through this financial downturn. There have been impacts on our overall investment portfolios, particularly the equity markets, but there will be no impact on the member premium as a result of those declines in market values. We've seen about an 8% decline in our investment portfolio over the entire portfolio. Blue Cross of Idaho, as a mutual insurance company, not a stock-held company, really targets an ongoing long-term underwriting gain of 2%. In other words, we need to generate about 2% over the long term to be able to keep pace with the increasing risk in medical claims costs. We expect to receive to achieve about a 2.2% gain this year. Next year, that will drop to about 1.2% if our forecasts hold up. We expect to see large companies continuing to reduce their staff. As they do, we'll lose members in our medical insurance plans, and then small employers are either reducing staff or dropping coverage. And individual insureds are dropping coverage as well. In the fourth quarter of 2008, we lost a total of 3,100 members, a little less than 1% of our overall medical membership. And about 700 of that was from the small group market segment, but 2,000 of it came from the individually insured. So we're definitely seeing the impact on the individual and insureds dropping their coverage. In terms of just understanding the financial impact of loss of membership, for each 1,000 member loss, while we would reduce our premium revenue line by about $3 million, the financial impact on the bottom line would be about $300,000. So in order to maintain our financial forecast, we would need to be looking into operating cost reductions, staff reductions, those sorts of things to cover just that roughly 10% or so of the premium loss. And we expect to see downward pressure throughout 2009, probably on into 2010 to some extent as a result of the economic conditions. But we also, as we always do, are looking for new accounts, increasing our market share. So our business plan actually has us growing about 3%, 11,000 members for next year. In terms of the industry as a whole, of course, we're just kind of trading. If we gain, somebody else loses. The accounts that we think that we'll gain in are, we believe, are insured through out-of-state insurance companies. So we would expect that, you know, the business done inside the state will probably increase somewhat. In terms of our staffing, I show a five-year representation of where our staffing levels have been. Our organization has been growing fairly strongly over the past several years, up through 2007, where we hit a high of 902 employees. We did reduce staffing in 2008, partly because of loss of enrollment, but also through programs of, about half of that reduction was really through programs of looking for operating efficiencies. We expect to add just a few staff, about 10 staff members next year, but these would be in kind of key areas where we need to be providing more service or adding staff on the administrative side so that we can control the cost increases on the medical side. One of your questions was, what percent of the state economy is represented by the health insurance sector? And I'll represent this in a couple of different ways. One is just from a total employment standpoint. There are 900. The last survey that I have from the U.S. Department of Commerce would have total employment in 2006, and the study was done in 07, of 915,000 employed. And I believe that the looking at our own employment and the other insurance carriers that are in state would have about 1,500 employees in that year altogether. And then brokers registered with the Department of Insurance were about 5,200, so they're part of the industry, although not employees of the insurance companies. So from a employment standpoint, we're a little less than 1% of the overall economy. From a perspective of what are the revenue streams that we see in terms of premium, and what percent of that is of the total sales and service of the state of Idaho, it's about 8 to 9%. But of course, that would include the services provided by hospitals, physicians, other ancillary health services that we pay and then include in premiums that are charged to our members. So what part of the overall state revenue are we here? Premium revenues, that's the way of our premium taxes are how the state gets its tax receipts from insurance companies. So that's included in the category of miscellaneous revenues that for this next year are projected to be $117.7 million. The insurance premium piece of that is $56.4 million. You see the pie chart there. The dark blue of 10% would be Blue Cross of Idaho's contribution there toward premium tax. And the other 37% would be all other insurance carriers, including property casualty, so all insurance forms. Just continuing on with the revenue stream to the state, premium taxes, long-term history here. We saw those increasing fairly significantly up through 2004 and 2005. The law was changed so that the out-of-state insurance or premium tax was, I believe, about 2.7%. In-state, it was 1.4%. They're increasing the premium tax for in-state insurers from 1.4 to 1.5 and bringing down the out-of-state insurance premium tax from the 2.7 down to the same 1.5 so that all insurance carriers in-state and out-of-state will be paying the same premium tax. So you see that's why the reduction there through the 2008 year 2009, it looks like there'll be a slight uptick in overall premium tax. Just to give you another perspective to understand the business of health insurance, this is Blue Cross of Idaho's history of premium tax and forecast for 2009. The red bars are really just a comparison of if we were to pay a corporate tax, income tax, instead of a premium tax, those tax receipts would be significantly less. One of your questions was related to what are the costs for insurance for the employer and the employee. So this is looking at just the commercial group insurance market. Average premiums would be to the employer would be about $246 across all small business, large business, there is typically a sharing of that with the employee on an 80-20 basis, so the employee would pay about 20% or $49 out of that. Ignore that $313 for a moment. I'll come back to that. The employer really gets charged the $246, or will end up paying $197 after they pass on through payroll deductions that $49. The employee then will, through their benefit structure, pay deductibles, coinsurance, and that will add another $67 on average to what the employee pays. Of course, those who are more healthy will pay less than that. Those who need more services will end up paying more than that. So the employee really ends up paying the employee share of the premium of $49, another $67 on average for deductibles, coinsurance, copays, for a total of $116, roughly 37% of the entire cost of health care costs for that employer. Just another note that at the bottom there, employers have also been increasing the deductible amount. A number of years ago, probably 4 to 5 years ago, the average deductible was in the neighborhood of $250 per beneficiary, and those have increased gradually to the point where now $500 and $1,000 deductibles are very common, and we're even seeing with the reduced benefit plans of deductibles up to $5,000. But on average, that has increased just in the past 12 months from $767 to $854, or about an 11% increase, which is just about a little bit greater possibly than what the overall medical trend is. So as employers see their costs going up because of medical trend, they're passing on an about equivalent proportion to the employee through higher deductibles. Just a perspective on where does the healthcare premium dollar go. The major segments, those large three segments to the left of that dollar bill graphic, are for direct healthcare costs, and that would be hospital inpatient, outpatient, physician, professional services, prescription drugs, et cetera. And so that's the 87.7% of the premium dollar goes to directly to those healthcare costs. And then the amount that we would retain for underwriting gains and to build up our capital to address that increased risk is 1.6%. Premium tax is really 1.4%, but when you average that out over fully insured, or the self-funded accounts and the fully insured accounts, it works out to about 0.8%. Broker commissions, 1.9%, and then the administrative costs that Blue Cross incurs to administer these plans is about 8%. What has been going on with medical trends, and where do we see that going in the future? So a representation here of what medical trend is. And so this is just what we see what the hospitals, physicians, ancillary healthcare providers pass on to us in terms of increased rates per service, but as much for just the increase in the volume for the services. So back before 2002, we were in periods of seeing 12-13%. That's been coming down gradually. In 2008 was the lowest year that we've seen in a long time. 7.2% is where we think that will end up. We still need to see claims run out for a number of months to be certain about where that number really is. And then we see an uptick again in 2009 to about 8.1%. The biggest reason for that is that pharmacy costs, prescription drug costs, were very low, have been coming down over the past couple of years because of our initiatives and other health plan initiatives to drive through the concept of getting generic drugs instead of the more expensive brand drugs. Pharmaceutical companies have also not been generating new products at the higher brand rates. And so we had a very low, about 2% increase in pharmacy trends in 2008. And we see that increasing to about a 6% trend in 2009. And then how does that projected trend of 8.1% for 2009 break down? Our expectations are that about that the hospital trends will go up about 4.6%. Most of that is a price change. We see more pressure on negotiated price changes as there are more and more uninsured. There's pressure on the hospitals to generate enough revenue to cover all of their fixed costs. So they go to the commercial insurance companies for larger price increases. The inpatient utilization is probably going to be about flat. We don't see a lot of more demand for hospital inpatient services. Hospital outpatient is the largest increase there, about a 12% increase. That's split about 60% of that, we think, is really driven by utilization. More services, more imaging, more outpatient services, as technology really allows for hospital inpatient services that used to be done on an inpatient basis are now moving over to an outpatient basis. Physician cost increases about 3.5%. Pharmacy, I mentioned before. And then the other category is just a mix of, it only represents 2% of the healthcare cost dollar. It's home health, ambulance, vision, hearing, et cetera. And another of your questions was how many employers do provide insurance. I have two studies compared here. The latest one is 2007. And then compared to 2005, so the blue bars are really the older study, 2005. So we see that for full-time employees, the number of that employers in the small employee market, so under 50, well, even up to less than 100, that has declined. So the number of employers offering insurance to their employees has declined over that two-year period, and of course, most significantly in the smallest under 10 employee size company. Interestingly, there was actually a slight uptick, probably not statistically significant here, but a slight uptick in the number of employers in the large employer market offering insurance for their full-time employees. On the part-time, though, we see a more dramatic change. Employers are making decisions not to cover part-time employees. And then another question was just what is the uninsured in the state of Idaho? So the good news here is that relative to all of the other states, we're improving. In 2005, we were ranked 34th in the state from the fewest number of uninsured to the largest number, and we've improved our position to the 30th ranking in 2007. So we're at about 14.7%, less than the average for the country. And then in terms of the future, of course, the two big issues that we'll be facing is Blue Cross of Idaho has the largest Medicare Advantage plan in the state of Idaho, and Congress has been looking over the past couple of years about reducing payments for Medicare Advantage plans. That will probably occur in 2009 as the new administration really is looking for ways to reduce the overall budget deficits. So we are expecting reductions in payments that we receive from CMS for those members. The impact on us will probably be that we'll either have to increase our premiums to our members, increase or reduce benefits in order to keep that product viable. And then overall health care reform, of course, is looming out there. We expect to see some change with these economic conditions. How aggressively they're able to implement those change is a big question in our minds as well. But we believe that any of the healthcare proposals that we've seen in any of the 13 states who are trying to adopt something or that are presented as national solutions, all of them include private health insurance plans instead of moving to some kind of a single payer system. So we expect to be around in the long term, although the rules of the game may significantly change for us. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Myers. Committee, any questions for Mr. Myers? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Myers, just a quick one. And Idaho has gone from 34th to 30th in our ranking for unemployed. Uninsured, excuse me. How do you account for that? What have they done, or is this something that's happening in other states that makes them worse?
Chairman Bear and Representative Saylor, what I would attribute it to most directly is that our economy has been more solid than the average of the states. The overall economic growth in migration of residents. So we continue to hold a stronger economy. So less people have been going onto the insured rolls, where in other states that has increased.
Senator Peel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank you for taking the time to visit with us today. It's refreshing to hear directly from a CFO and a vice president. I appreciate you taking that time. Thank you very much.
Oh.
And thank you again. I don't see no further questions. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Committee, I'd like to just take a moment and thank Mr. Olmstead for the treat he left during our break on your desk, the little dairy treat, unsolicited. Hopefully we'll know we'll have turned the corner next year when he comes with nice cheese platters. Our next presentation will be from our Budget and Policy Manager, Kathy Holland-Smith. Welcome, Kathy, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. I have an opportunity today to speak to you as you listen to all the news about the changes in the revenue for our state. Hopefully I can show you how that has impacted our state revenues to the general fund, and then what steps have been taken so far in fiscal year 2009 to mitigate the fact that we don't have those revenues that we expected, and to frame the 2010 discussion as to, I know I've been asked very bluntly, please help us understand, give us a couple of numbers that show how big the problem is as it relates to state government. And that's what I'd like to do. You have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that Mr. Houston is passing out. I'd like to quickly go through where we've been. It seems to me that it helps understand as we talk about percentages, because I believe that one of the challenges this next year will be an argument about percentages, percentage changes, where the reductions take place, what they represent, and those impacts. But let's talk about what we happened at the end of 2008, and that is that we had a cash surplus as we left 2008 of $248.8 million. And that is an important number, and the reason being is that it has tended to soften the changes or the cuts that have been necessary for 2009. But you need to remember, we do not have that cash balance going into 2010. And so that helps you understand the size of the challenge 2010 will be for the legislature as you make decisions in state government. We had a change in the revenue estimates from the time we met in the legislative session last year. For the very first time, we had an original estimate of over $3 billion, and that was a real landmark to go over $3 billion. And then quickly, January's revenues did not pan out as expected, and for the first time we had a change in the revenue estimate from the executive branch, and that went to $2.9 billion, excuse me. And then you can see as we go down, there were significant law changes that occurred. We had tax relief. We also had an economic stimulus, the federal conformance, that we took place in. And so we went down then to $2.87 billion in revenues. Following the end of the fiscal year, and traditionally we get a new August revenue projection, and we did, and it went down even further. It went down to a negative 4.9%. And that was a $2.76 billion revenue change. All, of course, you see we're all going in one direction, and it's all going down. Well, what does that mean for the state budget? When you look at the next slide, you can see that if you place upon the appropriations that were set last year, and you look at your first line, you have a beginning balance of the $248.8 million. We have a revised revenue estimate of a negative 4.9% of $2,766.3 million. We have transfers out, and that was just part of the budgeting process and the impact of different the fiscal notes. We had original appropriations. We had reappropriation and budget reversions. And in that case, we had $21 million that agencies were giving authority to transfer from 2008 into 2009. They didn't spend the money in 2008. They were given legislative authority to spend it in 2009. We have deficiency warrants. The majority of that $10.5 million is for fires. And that's something that we, it's unavoidable. That's the cost of fighting the fires on state lands. And we have them each year. We will have some discussion this year on the timing of those payments, and you'll hear some further news next week. And then in October, we had agencies requesting money, $15.2 million. The majority of that was coming from projected shortfalls in Medicaid. And so in response to the governor's reduced revenue estimate, the governor issued a 1% holdback, and that amounted to $27.3 million. You can see that in the blue. And so even though you see a negative $3.1 million for an estimated ending balance, the assumption was is that not all of those supplementals would have been approved. And that's really, that's typical. All of the requests are not approved. And so we assumed that we would have a balanced budget as of that time. And so then, of course, in December, some things changed even further. And I'm showing you a chart that just basically, or a table that shows you probably where we are at this time. As when we met with legislative council and proposed to them what we saw most recently, rather than a negative 4.9%, we really began to say, believe it's between a negative 8 and a negative 10%. That really does seem to be a realistic approach, seeing what had happened in other states, recognizing that our July, August, and September revenues would represent less and less of what would happen, likely happen in the coming months. Understanding that some of the job changes in the employment in Idaho would not show up until later months because of severance packages and so forth. And so if you look at a hypothetical, you can see immediately the difference between an expected, even the $2.766 billion that was a negative 4.9 to the $2.677 billion. So we were playing right around $90 million plus dollars in addition that would need to be addressed. And I'm going to go ahead and make sure that you know, and I think that many of you understand, that the governor's office has not issued a revised revenue projection for 2009. That will take place next week. The governor, in order to have a holdback, the governor is not required to issue a new revenue projection. The governor just must determine that there are not sufficient revenues in his understanding or his belief to maintain spending for the rest of the fiscal year. And so we will see a new revenue projection here this next week. But obviously the 4.9 will not, negative 4.9 won't be sustained. And we know that because the governor took action in December. And what the governor did is he took two major steps. Number one, on the transfers outline, the blue line that you see, the negative 20.8 million, he identified two funding sources that he could bring back into the general fund. One was $12 million of the $20 million that had been appropriated to the water board for the studies, the aquifer management studies. And the other dollar amount was the $5.6 million we had appropriated from the general fund to the permanent building fund. And so he identified those two pots of money and said, as part of my additional holdback plan of a 4% holdback, I want these fund balances to be returned to the general fund. And then secondly, what the governor did is he issued a 4% holdback. He upped it from 1%. And that comes to right around $114.4 million. Now, I've included the impacts of the legislative branches and the judicial branches in this calculation because what we know from conversations with our legislative leadership and with the judicial branch, they intend to partake in this reduction. Now, although it's the governor's holdback, we know the governor has publicly stated that he intends and would like to recommend to the legislature that this 4% be an ongoing reduction in state government. I think many of you have heard that. And I'm going to use that assumption as I go ahead and explain to you some of the numbers that we're using to look at. And so based on this, I have a negative 8% revenue projection, and that shows that you may have a $17 million balance. But I would be surprised. That's the more optimistic projection. I think, quite frankly, it's going to be closer to a negative 10, and based on that assumption, I think you will see that that estimated ending balance could be another $30 to $40 million in the red. So I'd like to speak to you a little bit about what that holdback meant and how it was implemented. Number one, as I said, it was an executive order, 2008.5. And that is on the governor's website, and he has details about that holdback. It's basically a 4% on 2009 ongoing appropriations. We appropriated just at $86 million of one-time money in 2009. That was not included in that calculation. So the governor recommended that this be on ongoing appropriations. There are some exceptions, and you will see them as you go through the budget information next week. To the same exceptions that were in the original holdback. A major exception is public schools, where the governor has a negative 4.3 from the general fund because he uses the public education stabilization funds to make that whole. Another exception is the Department of Corrections, where they have approximately a negative 2% reduction. And that is partially mitigated by the fact that they will be returning $4 million to the state general fund because the growth did not occur in the population as had been projected and funded. So they will actually have larger reductions in their total appropriations, and you'll see that next week. But that is part of the reason why it was not, they did not hold on to the full 4% is my understanding. We also have another area in which we have the health education programs. We're not subject to the holdback. And we have a couple of small agencies of which it was just a several hundred dollars, and the governor did hold them harmless from the holdback. Other than public schools, agencies were advised the holdbacks would be permanent. And as I mentioned earlier, the legislative and judicial branch are not on the executive order because that's how the law is spelled out, but we anticipate making the same cuts. I want to speak a little bit about the reserve funds that we have right now, because that is extremely an important tool that the legislature has committed itself to maintaining and to build in the event of an economic downturn. Talk a little bit about the fund balances. Just so you know, if any of you legislators have your fiscal facts book, we do have all these fund balances listed, and we will have them as part of the front end of the budget book in this next coming week, so you'll have those handily. Right now, the Budget Stabilization Fund, as of the end of 2008, had $140.6 million in the fund. And it is just very, very close to its statutory cap of 145, which is a certain percentage of the general fund revenue. And the fund does speak to the fact that it should only be appropriated over two-year periods. Only half of the money should be used at one time. And this is the only fund that speaks statutorily as to how the money should be taken out. Now, I think you also know the Budget Stabilization Fund is created in such a way that the legislature has a choice in good years. For instance, if you have one really good year and quickly have a bad year, that you could stop the transfer of any general funds into the Budget Stabilization Fund. And that's what happened the last time we had the big holdbacks in 2003. In this case, we did not have sufficient revenues in 2008 to mandate such a transfer, so that's not an issue. But that was a source of revenue that we maintained in the general fund last go-around. So we have $140.6 million at this time. We have a public education stabilization fund. And the public education stabilization fund has multiple purposes. A key one is which is the support units, the number of new students each year go up or down differently from what was appropriated. They can access those funds to make up the difference. And if there are fewer students, they can return funds to compensate for the fact that they did not need those resources. In this case, the governor has already recommended publicly that $60.7 million of that of the public education stabilization fund be used to offset any reductions in the general fund for 2009. So that leaves a balance, if the legislature follows that direction, of $53.3 million. Now, there is a mechanism in the Public Education Stabilization Fund if there are revenue shortfalls once the legislature goes home and to close out the end of the fiscal year. Those are not sufficient to deal with this problem. The legislature will have to appropriate this money to take care of this issue because of some of the technical of the language that works in the Public Education Stabilization Fund, whereas you cannot take out more proportionately from PSIF than you do the rest of state government. So there's a weighted, there's a formula that says you can, for instance, cannot take out 4% or hold agencies, reduce agencies by 4%, and then take out 4.3% from public schools. And so that's why an appropriation is going to be required to follow this direction, this guidelines. We have the Economic Recovery Reserve Fund. Now that was, the Economic Recovery Reserve Fund was created the last time that we had budget shortfalls. And the idea was that the cigarette tax revenues would go into this and it would be used in economic downturns. We know now that the cigarette tax has been redirected to pay for the bonds for the capital renovation, and it's also been redirected to pay for bond levy equalization. So there's not a new source of revenue going into this fund, but the legislature did appropriate $60 million a couple of years ago. At the time that there were some, it was just basically there was $60 million in excess in the general fund. There were some differences and of where maybe that money should be spent, and the legislature chose to put it in the Economic Recovery Reserve Fund. Originally, it was intended to be used to pay for a secure mental health facility, and when the revenues began to soften last year, JFAC decided and recommended to the rest of the legislature that that money stay in that fund, obviously to take care of any future problems. And so that's going to be a key tool to taking care of budget shortfalls in 2009. And so right now, we have a total of $260 million if the money from the Public Education Stabilization Fund is used in 2009. So what does that mean for 2010? when you look at the scope of the challenges that you will be facing as legislators, it is the 2010 base. I reduced it by 4%, which equals $54 million, because we know that the governor is recommending that 4% be permanent. And I think that that appears to be a very prudent action in the sense that I have not received any direction from the legislature that they would not go there. Budget cuts are a key tool when you don't have the money. This does not include public schools. So this leaves a base budget of $2,825.8 million. For 2010, I'm assuming that there's no revenue growth. So I just talked about between a negative 8 and negative 10% growth for 2009, probably closer to 10%, and I'm assuming no revenue growth. I think it would be presumptuous. We've never had 2 years in a row where we didn't have revenue growth, but we also created new revenue in those years, and I do not see any discussion of changing taxes or raising taxes at this point to deal with this problem. So in this case, I'm showing no revenue growth. And that means if we have no revenue growth, if you have an 8% downturn in 2009, you would generate $2,677,000,000 in 2010. If you had a negative 10%, you would generate $2,618,000,000. And so when I see the difference from the base, the first number that you see, the $148.7 million, once again assumes a more positive outcome for 2009, the $206.9 million represents a more pessimistic outlook. So that's when you talk about what shortfall is the base. Now you can generally say $28 million for every $1 million revenue shortfall is what we deal with. That's kind of a fast way to look at that, to say what is the size of the problem percentages-wise. And of course that represents between a 5 and a 6. Let's go to not only the base we have to deal with, but we have these maintenance items that we have to have challenges with. And I'd like to speak about some of them. Two of the largest have to do with public schools non-discretionary and Medicaid non-discretionary. I have a placeholder of $30 million right now for public schools. That includes due support units, transportation, and bond levy, and that's probably somewhat of a generous number, but not terribly generous. It's not as much as the request is, but that's what we're looking at right now. We typically appropriate about 70% of the requested support units each year because we get mid-year resets or mid-year new numbers, and they typically go down. When it comes to Medicaid right now, that includes caseload utilization and inflation. And last year, fiscal year 2009, we used one-time money for caseload. We followed the governor's recommendation. And that was because we had not seen caseload matching the amount that we had appropriated over the several prior years. We had 2 years in a row where Medicaid gave money back to the general fund. And because they were not terribly comfortable with the caseload numbers, that money was given as one time. We still are in a good situation when it comes to Medicaid and caseload. The general wisdom has been that when economic times go down, that the Medicaid caseloads go up dramatically. We are not seeing that at this time. Of course, we could have a delayed reaction, but that is not the case at this time. And the expectation on the part of the governor's recommendation is that Medicaid, there will be changes statutorily and through rule in Medicaid that will reduce the need for additional funding over and above the $30 million. I'm not speaking of this 2010 budget, I'm speaking of this 2009. With 4% reduction in Medicaid, there will need to be changes statutorily and through rules, and we'll need the federal government to approve that. So those are his 2009 numbers that are driving the numbers that I have on the screen. And so that gives you a range of a shortfall. If you just deal with public schools and Medicaid, you don't give additional resources for enrollment growth in higher education, you don't give pay raises to public school teachers and state employees, of which we know the governor has already publicly stated he does not intend to recommend, and seems just not practical in this environment. It means very minor increases in inflation and contract inflation, and that's probably a positive thing because we're seeing some of the private contracts for some of the larger operations come back in lower than we expected originally, so that's driving some of those costs down, and that's a good thing. The one situation that you have significantly different between this downturn and 2003 is that we had a corrections budget that was growing at 10%. We do not have that right now. We have flat growth from this year over last year, and that's a positive thing. And we don't see the Medicaid caseloads pushing up like we did at the same time. But it still does require significant discipline when it comes to increases in Medicaid under this scenario. So you see I'm showing the range of between $208 and $266 million if the legislature takes the same approach that the governor has publicly stated, and that is reducing base budgets by 4%, excluding public schools, and probably follows with a very, very skinny maintenance budget. And so what are the tools that we have? Where does the money come from? Well, I would like to just speak very quickly about where we're going now. We know that there's been a likely scenario where we will be talking about additional base reductions. The governor has asked all executive agencies to prepare plans that show for a 6% reduction in the spending for 2010. It may be a time where we have to have a serious conversation about public schools. We have always been very proud in our state that public schools have mainly stayed harmless during these times. And this will be a time, this will probably be one of the major issues, I think, of our legislative session about how does public schools fare in this discussion. Because more than half of the money has already been or will likely be removed from the Public Education Stabilization Fund. So where would that money come from if they were to remain whole for 2010? Postponed some large projects. I think that you can see that already the governor has moved in that direction by pulling back the money from the water resources and from the permanent building fund. There may be an opportunity to continue to discuss. We do have some buildings approved out there right now to be constructed that may be discussed by the legislature as far as postponing or holding off. Suspend or have a moratorium on some of the state mandates. We have some of our budgetary impacts that are automatic, and there are some mandates that are a little bit more broad, and it has to do sensitive subject, but when it comes to it has to do with pay for school teachers and state employees, whether or not there's any opportunity to make changes and so forth, and how that might be discussed. But there may be an opportunity in some of the state mandates not to sunset them or have them go away, but to have a moratorium, and that's been something that legislators have been discussing. Stabilization funds are obviously a key tool. We have other buckets of dedicated funds. We'll have some agencies who will propose to shift some of the general fund spending to dedicated funds. We've seen that already in the holdback plans. Transfer cash from dedicated funds to the general fund. We've been watching very closely those funds that have some fund balances that may not be necessary to continued operation, and you'll see that will be you'll see several instances where that will be the case. And then federal stimulus. That's the last thing I say, and I can tell you that if anybody knows, we know very little about what's likely to occur. But when it comes to the state budget, the most commonly discussed sources of revenue that would make a big, big difference. Now, you know the infrastructure, and that's typically been discussed in terms of transportation. But the federal Medicaid match for Medicaid is scheduled to go up. We could potentially be looking at a significant amount of money that would give us relief in Medicaid. There's some discussion, though, quite frankly, that there would also be strings tied to that, and we could be looking at some large expansions of CHIP and with any potential goals to have health care coverage for children. And so for many of the states, if they're going to be required to pay for that match, that could be a challenge. That could not may be something that's going to be difficult to accomplish. But we do see that potentially there's more talk right now of assistance with public education also. But there's absolutely doesn't appear to be any consensus or any immediacy to that solution. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope I've met your deadline, and I apologize. I know there's a lot of information there. If I can answer any questions, I'll be glad to.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Representative Becky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, I'd like to go back to the slide that talks about the reserve funds. Thank you.
please, maybe no. Go. Thank you.
Does that, well, I guess I'm curious about the piece of balance there, the 114, I understand that. Now, the 60 is roughly 4.3% of the 09 appropriation. Now, but it seems like you were talking in a most probable 8% assumption in 09. How can we only tap PSIF then if we're down 8%? Then how are we going to make it all balance out? In other words, I think you're going to have to hit that fund harder than the 60, it would seem to me, to stay whole, because that's the 4%, and if we end up doing the 2% that's held in reserve across the board, then you're up to 84 million-ish, and that seems to be a little optimistic, that scenario. Could you talk about that, please?
Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Bedke. When it comes to 2009, the assumptions that we're operating is that there are other one-time fund sources that were appropriated that would be targeted before there'd be any other significant reductions in either state government or in public schools. And so even regardless of the 10, negative 10 versus the negative 8, you're really looking at additional 30 to 40 million that would be necessary statewide to balance 2009. And My belief is that you will not see any other additional attempts to use PSIF to balance 2009, because just as an example, in 2009 there were $85 million of one-time money that was appropriated to state government. Of that, approximately $40 million was dedicated to Medicaid, and we see right now that we don't have any of that money other than about $1 million that is part of the holdback plans. So I'm assuming that will be the next target.
Follow-up second question. During your comment, you were talking about that we'll have a need to reduce the 2010 budget by 4%. Was that 4% over the 09 after the dust has settled? So that would be I guess the question is what percent over the 08 is, you know, year to year, 08 to 2010 to make this all fly. Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you first began to ask the question, Representative Bedke, I thought I could quickly answer it. I can tell you that for 2009, I'm looking at a base reduction of 4% of the original appropriation, ongoing appropriation for 2009. So it is not in addition to the 4% that has already been held back. When it comes to 2008, the difference between 2008 and 2009 general fund appropriation total funds was 4.9%. When I go back there, basically you're going back, you're creating a situation where the difference between 2009 and 2008 would be 1% rather than the 4.9%.
Follow up. Is that because of the beginning balance that you took into 09?
Thank you. That's exactly the case. That beginning balance makes all the world's difference for 2009.
Thank you. Kathy, can you please make a brief comment addressing the Millennium Fund?
I'd be glad to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, I don't have the Millennium Fund listed on this table, and I can tell the sensitivity because it's not typically defined as a reserve fund, but there is $69 million in the non-endowed portion of the Millennium Fund that the legislature could have access to. It's a statutorily created fund to be used for potential revenue shortfalls, and was used in the last downturn.
Thank you. Representative Kellen. Could you please use your mic? Thank
you. Are these funds invested, and if they are, what's their performance?
Kathy?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Representative, these funds are the state treasurer, and they're really short, considered to be short-term, and so they get the same type of return that the general fund does. It's fairly minimal. They're not long-term. They're not in long-term assets. And so they're like any other cash right now. We haven't lost the value of cash. You'll see there'll be instances in the future that you'll see that there will probably be some losses. So it's certainly losses in endowment and Millennium long-term investments in the Millennium Fund.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Kathy. Appreciate it. Committee, we're going to have just a brief comment from Mr. Houston for those committee members that we have scheduling conflicts this afternoon, have to catch flights. Just want to make sure that he's able to at least do an initial address to your homework. Thank you, Mr. Houston.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I've handed out to you is the worksheet, and then as you listen to the members this afternoon, you'll be listening to the universities, the tax commission, and the associated taxpayers, and they'll be making forecasts for 09, 10, and 11, and you can fill in those numbers. And then we'd like to have you do the same, make your projections for 09, 010, and 11. I will be filling these numbers in electronically, and I can email this to you tomorrow so that you'll have their figures total, but we'll need this by Monday morning.
Monday morning specifically?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it'd be best before the governor's state address, so I suppose before noon. Gives me time to compile it and make sure that you haven't looked at the governor's numbers.
Senator Hill, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Houston. So this is different than the one in our packet. You're adding another year here. I guess I haven't been considering 2011. Do we need to do a projection for that as well?
Mr. Houston.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hill, the chairman this year asked me to add that other year on here. Both from the other prognosticators, and I've added on for the committee members. I suppose it's the prerogative of the chairs, but that was my understanding.
Senator Kitty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, I think the reason that we put that other column in is 2011 might have significant impact on what we would do with one-time money and reserve funds between now and then. If the economy looks like it's going to turn in 2011, maybe we don't have to worry so much about preserving balances in those funds.
Senator Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ray, last year you emailed a really handy spreadsheet for those of us that are technically challenged, and it was magic. You could just plug the numbers in and it all worked. I'm hoping you will do that again. Is that possible?
Ray.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Keough, yes, this spreadsheet, you'll see it says there, to unprotect this worksheet, choose tools, protection, unprotect. This is the one that I'll just protect it for you, and it'll automatically take you to those cells under the committee member projection. You can fill in your numbers. It'll calculate the percentage changes. And then if you can email me that spreadsheet back or bring it back on Monday morning, and we'll have it that way.
Thank you. And for those committee members that will have to leave early today to catch flights, I'm sure they can grab Ray during the lunch for any further clarification. But thank you very much, Ray. He will speak to that further at the end of our committee hearings today. So the committee will take a lunch break now, and we'll be back here promptly at 1:30. Thank you.